Hello and welcome to episode 417 of Radio Free Nintendo. I am your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me as always are James Jones.
I'm here in spirit.
Guillaume Veillette.
I'm here the way I am. I don't know. But James threw me off.
He threw me off too.
You know, I almost never get to go first on the intros, so
this is why most shows don't like ask people to actually just say something when their name is
don't have the nihilists running one quarter of the seats.
Anyway, I just like to for people to always hear your voice so they associate it with your name if they're new to the show. But anyway, John Lindemann could not be here this week, and so we have in his place our good old buddy, Mr. Michael TYP Cole.
Streak free since 2007.
Yeah. Ain't no streaking with you, man. No, Mike is our frequent
good
guest.
Good to know.
And we are very happy to have him here this week. So we've got a lot of games to tell you about. And a little bit later, we'll do some listener mail. There have been some fun topics to talk about recently. A bunch of, Smash Brothers and Amiibo. No, not Amiibo, thank goodness.
No, we're talking about Amiibo. Let's talk about Amiibo.
Yeah, let's not.
Let's just do a whole podcast about Amiibo.
I think there's enough of that out there.
All right, see you next week, guys.
It's called connectivity. Yeah.
but what we will talk about is new business, and I figured Mike could go first.
So there was like an indie sale, I think, on the Wii U a couple of weeks back where if you owned one indie game, they give you a discount.
Right, the indie connection sale.
Yeah, so I took that opportunity to buy Guacamelee because I'd heard a lot of good things about it and didn't know much about it. So I downloaded it and I played a little bit of it before I left on vacation, and then I got a chance to play some more. I think it was last night, maybe two nights ago. So I'm probably about, 20-25% way through. I'm not really sure. I've beaten the first dungeon or temple or whatever you want to call it. And it's pretty fun. I got to say, it's the presentation really is striking, and it just seems pretty clever overall. I'm not so sure I'm crazy about the brawler mechanics because I don't like brawlers that much. But I don't know. Just it's the writing is pretty funny, and the character designs are just seems really imaginative. I guess it's Day of the Dead themed, but it. Just everything just seems to pop out, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm playing this almost entirely on the gamepad. I'm doing off-screen playing. Mm. It just works really well. It seems like a really good game for that. I guess.
Yeah, I played it mostly on my Vita and was very happy with that experience. So the gamepad should be pretty similar, just a bigger screen.
Yeah, I will say that I've already run into a couple places where I've been stumped, and I feel like maybe I'm just dumb, but it maybe the game just isn't telegraphing certain things that well. There's a section near the beginning where they're teaching you that you can go through thorns by rolling. And when you throw, there's like a shield.
Right.
But I don't think it had told me about the fact that I have like a meter associated with that. And so I was able to roll successfully through, you know, the first thorns. Then there's one where you have to jump in the air and go through a thorn. And I just kept dying on there, and I couldn't figure out why, but it had to do with something with this meter where I had failed, and I was doing the right thing. I just hadn't waited long enough to do it, and I had to look online just to find out what the hell I was supposed to do, and I had been doing it right. The timing was wrong or something. So
I don't think I ever noticed the meter, so yeah, that's surprising.
Yeah, and I guess there was one other spot where I don't know. I can't explain why, but every once in a while I run into a thing where I have the right idea. I'm not executing it correctly, but I don't realize the issues with my execution that I had the right idea, so I try something different. It's happened to me a couple of times in this game, and I can't quite put my finger on it. But maybe it's just me not being good enough. But overall, I'm really enjoying it still. It just seems really clever. A lot of the puzzles, at least the beginning, seem pretty pretty unique, you know, some of the swapping between the two dimensions or whatever you want to call them.
Right. That's
where
a cool mechanic.
You have to jump through the portals. That's all pretty cool stuff.
Did you get the power to turn into a chicken yet?
No, I don't think
it's basically it's the morph ball of this game.
Yeah. Well, that does not surprise me at all, given that there are Chuzu statues in the game.
Yes. Yes, of course. They should have called them Chorizo statues. I don't know why they didn't go for that obvious joke, but yeah, the chicken is fun because it's really fast and it's very tiny, but you can't attack when you're the, I don't think you can. Maybe you get an attack for it later on, but, Guacamelee is such a fun twist on a Metroid style game. And what surprised me about it, although it's been a couple years since I played the Vita version, but what I still remember about it is that as the game went on, I was really surprised at the cleverness of the platforming puzzles, you know, the exploration stuff, the, you know, trying to figure out how to get from A to B. It never stopped being fun to me. And they keep giving you abilities that drastically change how you play the game.
Right, because they give you attacks that basically like allow you to go straight up from being in midair, and that's going to allow you to break some blocks that you couldn't break before, but also it comes up in the platforming where you might have to go under an obstacle and then shoot up and then double jump. So they really exploit the fighting system and the moves like that to also like integrate that in the platforming puzzles.
Well, that's good to hear, because that's currently my favorite part. The kill rooms can just go to hell. I don't like the combat that much, I gotta say.
No.
But I mean, I tolerate it. Kind of like I tolerate a lot of the combat in Batman games, just because I love the atmosphere and presentation so much.
Yeah, I think I agree with kill rooms just generally as a rule of thumb are not good. You know, I don't like them. I remember there being some in Guacamelee, but they seem to be less prominent as the game goes on, and maybe that's just my
I don't know. They get pretty vicious at some point where there's enemies that have a countdown timer, and they blow up and kill you if you don't take them out early enough. So
I better learn those combo systems.
Well, mostly I just remember getting stuck on the bosses, because some of the bosses later on, and they're really cool characters. I mean, they're characters you probably have already seen, Mike, that you end up having to fight. And they're very well realized. They have a lot of personality. They look really interesting. They have crazy move sets, and you end up getting some aspect of their, it's very Mega Man in the sense that when you beat them, you actually get a power that you could see them using in that battle. And, but those boss battles towards the end, the last two or three of them are amazingly difficult. And maybe there was something about the battle system that I really wasn't using. I don't remember if I was rolling properly, you know, like maybe there's certain things that that could have made it easier on me, but I remember really, really struggling through that. But also when I beat those bosses, I felt amazing. It was like beating a Mega Man boss that's really hard, and when it's over, you're like, oh my god, I can't believe I did it. You know, it's actually pretty awesome. It's part of what makes that game very memorable, and I think you're gonna enjoy it a lot the rest of it.
Cool.
It doesn't slow down, that's for sure. The end game stuff in Guacamelee is crazy and really good.
How long is the whole game?
I would say about like 10 hours.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I would say. I think the Wii U version added some, like an extra dungeon or something like that. Because I was tempted to play it again.
Right. I've only played the Wii U version, and there's no like obvious area where it says, "Hey, bonus dungeon." Except maybe it's when you know, do New Game Plus or something like that. But I haven't gone back to the game.
Yeah, it could be. Yeah, I'm not super clear on what the differences were, but it was based on some DLC, I think, for the original version, and then with Wii U they bundled it in and just kind of integrated it into the main thing. But Guacamelee, I mean, really, if you like Metroid stuff, if you like Batman games, Spider-Man, you know, those 2D Spider-Man games on DS, Castlevania stuff, I can't guarantee you'll like it, because it is kind of a twist on that, on all those games, and it brings its own kind of challenge and its own little tweaks. But I think it's a brilliant game. I think a lot more people should play it.
Yeah, and I wouldn't be turned off by the whole Metroid thing, because there is a map, and especially on the Wii U, you can have the map at all times on the gamepad, and it always shows you where to go. It's kind of like Metroid Fusion that way. So you're never really, really stuck, and the powers open up color-coded areas, and you see those color codes on the map. So, you know, like you're never scratching your head thinking, where the hell were there purple blocks again in this area, you know?
Unless you're colorblind.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, that might make it trickier. Mostly, I think the really, really crazy platforming that I remember is to go back to certain areas and look for the extra optional power-ups, you know, heart container type stuff, basically. Yeah. And that's when you end up like flying through, you know, crazy places up in the sky that don't even seem remotely close to the area that you were in before. And, you know, going through like little tiny cracks in your chicken form to uncover this crazy underground area that's, you know, that you didn't even know was there the first time you went through the area. That stuff's really fun for me, but it's optional. All right. So, Mike, why don't we come back around to you, actually, and move on to Guillaume, hear about what you've been playing.
Sure. Well, I just downloaded today. This game came out, Black, on the Wii U, which is apparently a port of an iOS game. So maybe a lot of people have already played it, but it just came out on the Wii U. No, but it's actually really, really good. It's this puzzle game, very simple. And it's a puzzle game that I've never really seen anything like that before. Basically, with a stylus on the gamepad, on the touchscreen, you trace a shape, like a, you just do, you know, like, I don't know, like you just do a trace. And this trace will be repeated over and over again, like it will just be chained. And the goal is to kind of go and touch these dots on the screen and to avoid the black dots, which are holes. And so, like, you might have, I don't know, like, you might have one dot surrounded by two holes, and you might have to do kind of a half circle trace on the gamepad to make it so that your line is kind of bouncing around and then avoids, like, goes around one of the holes, touches the dot that it's supposed to touch, and goes over the other hole. It's really hard to describe. Like, actually,
you always pick the games that are the hardest to explain.
I know, and like this time, I'm not the only one who has trouble describing it, because the freaking press release today and on the eShop in the description, they tell you like, oh, it's hard to explain with words. Just watch the trailer. So if you're out there, like, just watch a trailer, you'll get a better idea of what it looks like. But it's really, really cool, and looks like Broken Rules ported this game for the Wii U, and I just really love their games. Like, it looks like they didn't have a hand in actually like developing it, but they brought it to the Wii U.
Do you love Chasing Aurora?
No, but I did love And Yet It Moves, and yeah, it's kind of funny. I don't know if this was the case in the iOS game. But, you know, in And Yet It Moves, they had kind of these, I don't know, human-made sounds in it. Like when you would fall from a great height and your character would explode, it would basically be like just like a, you know, or something. Like, I can't really do it, but there were these kind of, yeah, like the sounds were made with mouths. I don't know how else to describe it. The latest Miyazaki movie actually has that as well. Like, The Wind Rises, all the airships are just making like pop sounds.
I didn't know that.
It's
really,
really, really weird. And in this case,
I didn't notice,
like,
it when I saw the movie.
Really?
It didn't stick out to me.
No. Some people found it really distracting. I thought it was kind of cute. And in this game, it's really, really funny, because depending on where you end up like screwing up, and the, like when your line goes inside a hole, you just like hear this zoop, you know, and sometimes it makes this kind of, I don't know, like noises that Karen and I make to each other when like we're, you know, exasperated.
What?
Or
okay, good save, you know, because if John was here, I would have just been throwing him out the whole time.
Well, some readers have been, you know, noticing that I've got my patented, like, you know, so it makes sounds like that, and it's really, really, I don't know, it's pretty funny.
I want someone to excerpt sounds from this podcast that Guillaume has made just now and put them in a game.
Ah, that would be pretty awesome.
And yeah, then I get Earthbound royalties. Did that a little bit. You know, there were certain sound effects in Earthbound that sound like recordings of people just going, mm-hmm, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Some of the Mr. Saturn sounds you hear are kind of like that.
Yeah. Black, like I'm about like 20 or 30 puzzles in. It's really getting hard. And there's sometimes, I don't know, like we've been struggling against some of these puzzles, like wondering like what the hell, like every time, because you have to be really steady, right? And you have to trace your line so that basically it will, start where it ended. It will end where it started, like on the same level. Otherwise, your line is just going to keep going up and up and up, and you're not going to be, you know, going exactly where you want the trace to go. Anyway, so you have to be like, you have to have some talent, like tracing stuff and having a steady hand, and you have to figure out things visually. You know, sometimes they try to throw you off because they'll make the screen asymmetrical. And you have to draw on the left side and the dots are on the right side. And so it's hard sometimes to gauge exactly where you're supposed to start your line, where you're supposed to end it. And, it's really challenging, but I've noticed that it seems like the simpler the shape that you trace and the easier it is. Like sometimes the solution might seem really complicated and you might be tempted to like go, okay, so I'm going to go really high up here and then go down there. And then I'm going to like, trace the circle. And then, you know, because it just seems like it's the only way that you're going to connect all the dots. But then it turns out the solution is much, much simpler.
Hmm.
It's challenging. It's deceptively challenging and, it's pretty fun.
Between now and when this podcast comes out, I'm going to watch a video of this. And when I listen back to the final version, I'll probably understand you in a completely different way as you were describing this game.
It's a challenge. Especially since I just played it like an hour ago. Like it's, I don't know. I did not have time to prepare and to really like figure out how to describe this, but,
it's cool. Important thing is you like it. You recommend it.
Yeah. And it's about $7. Maybe you can, probably you can find it cheaper on iPad, but if you've got a Wii U and you like puzzle games, so far it's pretty good.
Yeah, I'm going to say you can definitely get it cheaper on iPad because sells for $7 on iPad.
No, it doesn't.
Nope.
You can't sell a game for that price. That's too expensive. Okay, well, I'm going to keep the indie game train rolling here with Moon Chronicles Episode 2. Because this is the Renegade Kid first-person shooter originally out on DS. They remade it for 3DS and decided to go episodic with it, except kind of not really. That was the original plan. They released Episode 1 almost a year ago, I think. Maybe May of last year. And then we just didn't really hear anything about the other episodes, and we waited and waited, and it's like, guys, it's been 6 months. This game already exists on another platform. You might want to go ahead and release the next episode. And I think they ran into some certification troubles with Nintendo, or maybe they got distracted working on Zeo Drifter, and they just didn't have the bandwidth. But it was a really botched rollout of this game, needless to say. And now in early February of 2015, they released the rest of the game just all in one go. So it's still episodic in that they're selling episodes 2, 3, and 4 separately, but they released all of them on the same day. And you can buy a season pass, which is kind of hilarious, but you can buy a bundle of all three of those episodes together for a reduced price and basically just complete the rest of the game that way. And that's what I did. So I believe the original release of it, the first episode last year, I believe, was like $9. And it's only like an hour and a half of content, probably. So it's not like a great deal, frankly, especially when you consider that it's basically, you know, just a big cliffhanger. You know, it's only the beginning of the game, and you paid $9 and it's over pretty fast. And you know you're going to have to spend more. We didn't know how much more. If you buy, I think I want to say these new episodes are $4.50 a piece, and if you buy all three together, then it's $9 for all three. So basically, I paid $18 for the full game, which is certainly less than it cost on Nintendo DS back in 2009, 2010 when it first came out.
Right, but about like 3 years ago, I got a used copy for $5.
Sure, yeah. It's $18 for this whole thing is not the best deal, quite frankly. Now, as of the last week, they were selling episode one for half price, so that was $4.50, and then you could get the rest for $9. So that helps a little bit, you know. And sure. Being that this is a Renegade Kid game, I would expect that the price will be discounted frequently, and they will find ways to make it affordable and try to keep people talking about it for a long time, because they're very active when it comes to that stuff. They're good about it. But yeah, I don't think it's a great deal. I don't think Moon is an incredible game. You know, I played the early part of it when it first came out because it was sent to me because I was helping to ship things at the time, I guess. I don't remember exactly, but I ended up sending it off to somebody else to review. But I played like the first couple hours because I was very curious about it. And I was like, it feels kind of like an N64 shooter, you know, but 10 years later. and I have to use the touchscreen to aim. And right. That part I don't like very much. You know, I don't really like playing first-person shooters with a touchscreen.
But it works so well on the huge boon of DS first-person shooters we saw.
I mean, there were a few, mostly from Renegade Kid, and I have not played...
Because they didn't get the message.
I have not played Dementium 1 or 2. I mean, they are first-person games. I think they're less shooters than they are more like horror games. There's right. some shooting, but not a ton. And I think it's a little more like Zombie U in that sense. And they are remaking those for 3DS right now. So, or at least the first one, probably both. And I am kind of curious to see how those turn out. But I really feel like, these are old games. They are doing some work to update them, but it's not like Moon Chronicles looks like a modern 3DS game, because it definitely does not. It looks like a DS game. And it's a DS game with not the greatest art design, frankly. I mean, it's all very kind of austere, and the alienness of these environments you're going through is kind of half-hearted, I think. It's a lot of just hallways and, you know, green grid pattern walls. I mean, the enemies are mostly just these robot things that fly around and shoot at you. I mean, they don't really look like much of anything. I will say the bosses are cool. I mean, I've seen three bosses so far. I'm through the end of episode two, so I'm halfway through the game now. And I've fought, I think, three bosses, and they're all different. They're all pretty cool in their own way, and you have to approach them differently. And they are challenging as well. You kind of have to go in and figure out some kind of tactic where you won't take very much damage, and you can get a lot of free shots at them, and it takes some skill. So I've been pretty impressed with the bosses. If you think about it, you know, like Metroid Prime Hunters on the DS, which is a pretty similar game in some respects, that game had terrible boss. I mean, it had basically one boss that you repeated three or four times with slight variations. Ironically reprised in Zeo Drifter in 2D, but I digress. Moon Chronicles, it definitely does do better in bosses. And they add some neat... ideas that mix it up, so it's not just a kind of, you know, generations past first-person shooter. I mean, a lot of this game feels kind of like The Conduit, except simpler, like more basic, because there aren't as many enemies on the screen, and there's not – the environments are very empty, and there aren't as many weapons, and the weapons aren't as cool. In fact, the main basic weapon, the only one that has unlimited ammo – is one of the worst weapons I've ever used in a first-person shooter. I don't understand what they were thinking with this thing. I mean, it shoots three shots at a time, and it has a ton of kickback, so you can never aim on anything. You're constantly having to adjust your aim on the touchscreen just to even keep the bead on the enemy. And most of the enemies zigzag all over the place. And so it's super inaccurate. It takes like 15 hits of this thing to kill even the simplest enemy in the game. It's just a pea shooter. I mean, it's just the worst design for a weapon in a first-person shooter. I don't understand it. But some of the other weapons you unlock are more fun to use and more powerful. So I guess it can be forgiven. But, you know, Moon Chronicles, I mean, it's unique in a way. And it is cool that it's on 3DS. I mean, it's in 3D. It runs at a really high frame rate. It controls well for what it is, you know, given the limitations of the system. And it does support CirclePad Pro, So I'm saving the last two episodes for tomorrow or the weekend coming up, because we're about to get the new 3DS XL. And I'm very curious to see how that little nub works with a first-person shooter and dual-stick control scheme.
So you're getting the new 3DS day one?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. We've got a pre-order at Best Buy. Yeah.
Huh. I'm kind of surprised. I thought I would be the only sucker.
Nah.
No, there's two.
Come on. Come on. No, of course I am. I don't know what the hell I'm doing with my old system, but I'll figure it out. I wanted to play some of it on the old system before the new one comes out, just because it's been so long since I played episode one. I wanted to kind of remind myself of what it feels like and what this game is doing, and then I'll report next week on whether the experience is improved at all on the new system. If you are really fascinated by the idea of playing a first-person shooter on a handheld, it's the only one on 3DS, certainly. Yeah. There's a few on Vita, but none of them are all that great. And Moon Chronicles is not great. But it's good. I think the exploration parts of it are probably better than the shooting. And there's I don't know what to think of them. There's some vehicle sections of the game where you're like out on the surface of the moon in this rover tank thing that are very reminiscent of the first Mass Effect. So if you love the vehicle stuff in the first Mass Effect, I don't think most people do, but it reminds me a lot of that. I mean, it's different. At least it feels different. You have this little robot rover thing that you can pluck out at any time and control it independently, and it's very low to the ground. It can go in these little tunnels, and it has a paralyzing shock ray. It's neat. I mean, they do think of some cool little things to do with this stuff. I think mostly I would like this game way more if the shooting actually felt good, and it doesn't. But there's more to the game than just shooting, so I'm sticking with it. I'm kind of on the thing as a whole. But I'm going to stick it through and try to finish it. It's been a strange saga of this game getting released. By the way, the process to even buy these extra episodes is horrendous, because you have to go to the eShop and update. You have to own the first episode to begin with. You have to own that to buy the other episodes. Then you have to go to the eShop and update the game to give it the patch that allows you to buy the other episodes, except it didn't show up in my list of titles that I've downloaded with the update button. It didn't show up there. I had to actually search for it in the shop and go to the main shop page, and there was a button to let me update it.
Oh, wow.
And then once I downloaded the patch, then I have to leave the eShop, wait for the patch to download, then boot up the game, then go into the game and go to the DLC section where it lists the prices and everything. And then once you click on that stuff, it takes you back into the eShop through the game to buy this stuff. The whole process took like 20 minutes. Like, what the hell? I mean, who wants to play this game that bad that they're going to go through all of this and pay, frankly, too much money to do so? I don't get it. I mean, I'm kind of taking a hit for the team here just because I'm super curious about the whole process and about the game itself. But, and a lot of this, frankly, is probably Nintendo's fault and not Renegade Kids in terms of the complexity of this and the awkwardness of it and maybe even the pricing. I don't know. But it's a big mess. But I'm glad the rest of the game is finally out. And clearly this paves the way for them to do other things. And, you know, the sad part to me about them saying that they're going to put a lot of effort into updating Dementium 1 and 2 is that those are also DS games. And I really want to see what these guys could do with the 3DS hardware, like make an actual 3DS game of this, you know, in this vein, something like this. But I mean, they are good with technology. These games were very impressive on DS. They just don't look that good anymore. It's been a long time. And I don't know that they hold up all that great. But I think playing with the other joystick will be very interesting. So I'll let you know next time. But for now, let's move on to James.
Yeah. So there's a new Kirby game out. It's cute and charming, and I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about something else entirely, something dark and heavy. So I have a I'm going through this tear of the PS3 games I bought late in its life, or even after its life, and weirdly, a lot of them were Tecmo Koei, whichever order they put their names in this week. And one of them is from a series that is called Deception, this specifically being the fourth iteration of the game.
Originally called Tecmo's Deception.
They were.
That's how they branded it on the PS1.
And in fact, the Tecmo logo, the bone, you know, standard Tecmo logo shows up in the game, which is weird to see at this point, because they've been TK, KT for a while now. And in fact, well before this game came out, but they went in there because I guess this is as a company, they haven't really invented any new brands. So a lot of these brands are with one of the two sides of the house. So a lot of times they're still sort of semi-branded with the old company's logo. I saw this with like Atelier, which this game is not. So in this game, you play as the daughter of Satan. Explicitly. Right in the introduction, you are Satan's daughter. Well, okay. Cool.
And you're tempting Al Pacino.
And you are essentially tasked with reviving Satan. So if you win, you have doomed the earth. So this is kind of, talk about games you play as the villain. I think I got it covered. The premise of the game is you as this anime girl wearing not a whole hell of a lot with one horn sticking out of her head because she is the daughter of Satan and heterochromatic eyes runs around a castle setting traps for adventurers who have come to kill you. That is the game. Essentially, you queue up these traps, things like bear traps or giant pendulum swinging guillotines or harpoon guns sticking out of the wall, spike traps, rocks that you can drop from the ceiling that roll down sloped inclines. And you try to do things like knock them into brazing bowls or knock over pillars onto people or just hit them with the trap you've put in there. It's a real screwed up game.
Is this done in turn-based?
No. So you run around in real time and they pursue you in real time. You can stop the action to put down traps. The game just pauses because ostensibly you are the daughter of Satan. You are essentially putting these traps down magically. And
this sounds like Lemmings or something.
A little bit, except way more sadistic. So essentially you put down the traps. They have a cooldown and they're sort of queued up. You have an order. So you trap one, trap two, trap three. And what you're trying to do is you're trying to set them up. So one sort of feeds the unsuspecting victim into the next, which feeds them into the next, which ultimately ends their existence. And you get scored for this based on your creativity using these traps, which makes it real macabre. And in fact, there's three different scoring systems. There are traps that are regarded as being sadistic, which is things like heavy axes and stuff like that, real, real messed up stuff. There are traps that are designed to basically inflict shame, embarrassment's not the word they use, but essentially they're humiliation. That's the term they use. And then there are traps, they just sort of applaud you because of their technical nature and executing them is more complicated. So to give you kind of an example of what you're dealing with, I had a situation where one of my demon handlers had asked me to essentially launch my pursuer into an electric chair. It just didn't kill him, but it hurt him really badly. But he would not follow me over there, so I couldn't just easily knock him into it. So instead, I put down a rake on the ground, which is a humiliation trap, that when he stepped on it, stunned him one space over, from which I made him... Exactly.
You put down a rake and he stepped on it?
Yep, and it knocked him backwards.
It's just Sideshow Bob.
It is.
This is so ridiculous.
At which point, he fell backwards onto a space, and I hit him with a launcher on the floor that sent him into the air, and I knew where he was going to land, at which point... When he landed, I dropped a giant jack-o'-lantern on his head, which made him stagger in whatever direction he was previously moving, which I had just adjusted, for four spaces until he hit the stage trap.
So basically is a giant Rube Goldberg.
Yeah, essentially. And it's just a real, real messed up through bolt. Yeah. And the game adds complexity with things like there are enemies who are immune to certain traps. Like there was an enemy that I had to make her stuck in the bear trap for the objective. I could just clear him out and not worry about the objectives, but you want to get more points so you can buy more traps. And she could not be caught by them unless you managed to make her dodge into one. So I had to put down another trap to force her to dodge into this one and set it off right in time. And since you have control over them and there's a slowdown on them, it's a lot of like you set them down. And you just kind of try to lead the person into it, and you sort of make them move back and forth, and then you just have to time everything. It's really... Here's the thing. Is it a good game? No, it's not. Is it amusing? There are moments where this game is amazingly amusing, where you've set up three traps and a stage trap, and you just, you know, it ends with the entire, the chandelier of a building or of the main hallway of the castle just falling on a guy. And you're just like, yeah, I did that. I feel good about this. But there's lots of time of just setting up traps, trying to bait the person to step on the exact right spot on the grid, and they see something and they dodge out of the way, and you reset your whole process. Alternatively, you can just cheese it out with like the same three traps. And the game rewards you for experimenting, but ultimately those same three traps tend to, in conjunction, work every time. So there's been a lot of that of me kind of experimenting with trying to make the game more like a game of mousetrap and less of just, I'm going to launch him with the launcher. He's going to land on the thing where I'm going to drop the pumpkin head on him. He's going to walk into the other thing over and over again. So, I mean, literally the game rewards you for things like combos. Like, oh, you paired together two humiliating traps, so now you're going to get double your credit for it. And then the little demoness that represents humiliation might come out and congratulate you for being a real piece of work. So I haven't revived Satan yet. I'm still kind of working my way through it. The game can be somewhat difficult, but it is certainly an experience that only exists thanks to the magic of Japan. I will say that It's kind of unbelievable this got a box retail release. I mean, no, it's incredibly unbelievable it's got a box. I mean, how is this game out in North America and why? But they did it, and I don't understand Tecmo Koei's business model is what I'm saying. I mean, I really don't.
You do.
I don't. They don't either, apparently.
You do.
I do like that their localization is just, we'll just translate the text. Voice acting, we'll leave all the voice acting in. I don't give a shit.
Yeah, that's what Sega eventually did with Yakuza.
Yeah, it makes so much more sense in that game. Like, like having Mark Hamill play a crazy person, whatever, but it's really inauthentic.
So this isn't nearly the same thing, but something about your description of Deception made me think of a game I have not thought about in probably 10 years. And I had to look it up just to make sure that I hadn't dreamed it. It's called Disney's Hide and Sneak. It is a Mickey Mouse stealth action game.
There we go. Yeah, I mean, it's basically
the
same game.
Is this the Capcom game, or is it something else?
It was made by Capcom. It is the sequel, if you can believe it, to Magical Mirror, starring Mickey Mouse, which was like a very early GameCube game.
Wow.
Which was a point-and-click adventure.
Yeah, that's all I was thinking of. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, this is kind of neither here nor there, because I was thinking, wasn't there like a Mickey Mouse game where you had to set traps? But it was really more like you're kind of pushing blocks around and trapping enemies and then trying to like sneak past them. And then every now and then you could activate this cutscene that would like make Mickey jump on top of an enemy and kill it or something like that. But it wasn't really traps. So I'm just amazed I can remember this game at all. I gave it a 4 out of 10.
There you go. High praise.
The abstract is tiptoe quietly towards better kid games.
There we go.
I don't even remember writing. This was from February 2004, so 11 years ago.
Jeez.
And, yeah.
I will say,
I've been doing this shit for too long.
Well, I totally forgot that I reviewed a Mr. Driller game, and I denied it even after Greg reminded me.
Yeah.
I was going to say real quick, one thing I will say about the game that it is meant to be funny, I suppose, even if you could, you know, just kind of say it as funny. But since every enemy has their own stats and weaknesses and stuff, you get their backstory when you activate your devil's eye. And every single one of them is the dumbest thing that has ever been written. And then the next one will come out and it is even stupider. So I'm like, it'll be like, told so-and-so, which just happened to be the soldier you just last finished off, that he had something really important to tell her when they get back. Oh, well. It's like, jeez, what the fuck game?
So these aren't like, this isn't like information about the kind of monster that you killed.
There's no monsters. These are just people. It's just straight up soldiers who are here to kill Satan's daughter. And you just said, no, I'm not going to have this.
Okay. But the stuff that you're finding with the devil's eye is actually like their inner thoughts.
Yeah. It's just like,
It's like flavor text about what that particular unit that
you kill. one of them was, he joined the military because he had a problem with eating. He figured a regimented life would make it so he could control his eating better. It was successful. He feels pretty good about it. It's like, what the fuck?
That's awesome.
This is the most Japanese game I've played this year, and that's saying something already.
That is saying something, and it's only February, so we've got a long way to go. All right, well, let's flip back around to TYP for a few thoughts about Pokemon.
Yeah, so I bought Pokemon. Well, I got it as a present, but I asked for it. I got Pokemon Y, which obviously is not the most recent Pokemon release, but it's a pretty current game, and I seemed that was the better modern game to go with. So,
well, it's the only modern game because the other one's a remake of a really old game.
Okay, well, then. So, the last Pokemon game I played before Pokemon Y was Gold and Silver. I don't remember if I had Gold or Silver, but that was a long time ago. I think I played Blue as well. But the whole Pokemon game mechanics, I mean, it was all very blurry. It's like, I played it. I remember liking it. Man, I feel like playing an RPG. Let's go with Pokemon. You know, I give it another try. So it's actually kind of a weird experience for me because I remember very little about my first, you know, Pokemon game and Pokemon Gold, Silver. But everything is just so familiar. You know, it's like dredging up old memories and I don't know. I'm having a lot of fun with it. That's all I can say. It looks beautiful. And it is familiar, but I think there's some new tweaks. And maybe it's because, again, I've skipped so many Pokemon games that things that are probably been around for 8 years are new to me. But it seemed like a really good place to pick back up with the series. I really like the way they've presented the Pokemon in terms of the visual style. I like how each Pokemon has its own kind of special attribute, which I think is pretty cool. Where I don't know, maybe it'll make it so that they're able to shake off certain ailments more easily, or if you touch them, then you know, if the other Pokemon has a attack that touches them, then they'll catch on fire or something. I think there's a lot of little mechanics in there that are very subtle but work really well. And it's so hard to tell. It seems like the gyms are pretty spaced out in this game. Maybe that changes later in the game, but I've only gotten through maybe two gyms, but it seems like I've been playing for 20 hours or so. Maybe that's because I'm stopping to sniff the roses, so to speak.
No, there is a section of the game where the two of the adjacent gyms are really far apart from each other. And I remember that too. Once you find the next one, the rest will flow fairly quickly after that, okay. I think. Yeah.
One thing
it's
I was
because they
want to
take
with
a break and teach you about mega evolutions or something like that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They're prodding me along. Oh, we got to find out about those mega evolutions. Mm-hmm. Oh, I don't know anything about mega evolutions. Let's find out about mega evolutions.
Mega evolutions are opportunities to sell more toys.
Yeah,
maybe. But the weird thing about Mega Evolutions is that once you get them, they do look cool for sure, and they make your Pokemon more powerful. So I used them a lot. I never understood why you wouldn't use them. I don't. Maybe they amplify your Pokemon's strengths, but also amplify its weaknesses or something like that. But the game never really explained to me, or I never picked up on what is the limitation here. You know, I mean, it's like, every time you pull out that monster, it'll say, it's holding its Mega Evolution Stone. Do you want to Mega Evolve it? And I'm like, well, yes, of course I do. I mean, why would I say no? I never understood why you would say no. Maybe I just missed it.
Every time you do it, it moves one step closer to death.
You know, that would be an interesting mechanic that Pokemon will never do.
You monster. You killed them. You killed them.
I don't know what all to point out about this game. I'm sure it's been talked about to death, but as someone who was kind of a casual Pokemon fan way back when, it's worth coming back to. If you're someone who, you know, played a Pokemon game a long time ago and never bothered with it, I think it's worth going back to because it's a fun RPG. I'm actually surprised at how much I'm enjoying just, you know, collecting the monsters and not trying to get them all, but it's just, you know, it's just kind of fun to see all the different crazy creatures that are out there.
Well, and that's where the 3D presentation really comes into play. And I don't just mean the stereoscopic on 3DS, although that's nice when it works, when they actually bother to make the game 3D. Yeah. But also just the polygonal models. I mean, it's the first game. If you can – it's amazing to me. If you go back one game previous in Black and White 2, those Pokemon are still sprites. Yeah. They don't even look that much better than the ones that you remember from Gold and Silver. And and just going around and even though, you know, some of the polygonal models of these Pokemon are, you know, kind of simple. I mean, they're not like overly complex. Some of them are actually really cool looking. But it really does make it more fun to go capture all these monsters just to see what they look like. And mm-hmm. especially when there's like 5 or 7 or 1,000 of them. I don't know how many are in that game. There's a shitload. And I was the same as you. I had skipped a bunch before I played Y. And so virtually every monster I caught was new to me. And mm-hmm. I'm like, they made a Pokemon out of that, you know? So yeah. It's always kind of exciting when you pick up a new one. And sometimes I would go out in the field and just like a little kid, I would randomly come across a monster. I thought it looked really cool and I immediately just wanted to catch it. Mm-hmm. Probably would never even use it. But you know, right. I was out fighting in the ocean and I saw a shark that was also a torpedo. And I said, by Jove, that will be mine. <You know? laughs> And there's a lot to be said for that. That's really what Pokemon should be about. That's exactly how it should make you feel. And I love that it can still do that to us adults when the presentation is really done nicely. And that's exactly why I jumped back into the series for this one. Because it's like, oh, they actually made the game look nice.
Yeah.
That's kind of important to the series. Mm-hmm.
If you haven't heard, Johnny's new job is greenlighting sci-fi original movies.
Yeah, Sharkpedo. Nintendo's already got the copyright, so don't even think about it. Trademark. Trademark, I guess, not copyright. Yeah, well, hey, man, you'll enjoy that. It's a fun game. It's easy. It's short. It's really accessible way.
Is it short? Because I feel like I played it for 20 hours. I don't think I'm that far in.
It's short in that you can beat it in probably 50 hours, and compared to most other Pokemon games, yes, that is short.
Okay. All right.
Yeah,
there you go.
I think so. Yeah. And it is easy. Definitely easy.
Isn't the method to beat a Pokemon game really fast is to just focus on the one Pokemon and not try to have a rounded team? That's what I keep hearing. Just have like your normal type Pokemon be really, really powerful and just power through everything.
Well, I mean, I am tending to keep the same three in my party, and I kind of rotate the others. I don't know if that's
that's what I did too. Hmm. It's like I want some that are dependable, but also mm-hmm. I want to, you know, see different ones in action and kind of mess around with it. So yeah, I like that you can balance out your team that way. Cool. Well, Guillaume, you're up next with a game that sounds like it was named by a 3-year-old.
Okay, so yeah, no, I've been playing another indie puzzle game on the Wii U eShop, It'll Do. Yeah, it came out last year. You know, like it doesn't seem to make any sense, but I think that, yeah, like Mike just put the finger on it. I think it's supposed to be a play on words. It's supposed to sound like It Will Do. Because this is very much like kind of a comedy game and an homage or maybe even a ripoff, like very much inspired by Zelda games. You're playing as this kind of tomboy who the game starts without any explanation. Basically, you're on a raft, you're stranded at sea, and then you bump into, you know, rock, and okay, so you're in an island and there's a gigantic castle and let's go adventuring, you know. But you do like meet one guy, there's one inhabitant, and he's got his name is Itan, and he's got an item shop. So you go to Itan's shop and he will build you a new raft, but first you have to go, like, you know, retrieve the doodad, the MacGuffin for him, and then, you know, you'll be able to leave the island. And you're very much like a keen adventurer, and you're like, yeah, sure, let's go. And the game is really, really charming. It's really, really, it looks great. Like, it's got this kind of hand-drawn look to it where, you know, the drawings kind of shimmer a little bit, kind of like how they did in Yoshi's Island. but of course at a much higher resolution, you know? It's just when you talk to people, when you encounter enemies, you first talk to them. So you've got these big portraits during the conversation scenes, and they're not animated, but they might as well be, because every time that you move on to the next sentence, they're in a new pose, you know, and your character keeps making new faces. Like it's, for instance, there's this place where you see some statues, some gargoyles, and so you go to them, you press A, and you see the close-up of them, and they're making, you know, like horrible faces, and there's like dot, dot, dot. So you're like, okay, that's pointless. And you press A to move on to the next line of dialogue, and it's just your character also saying nothing, but she's making the same face. And, you know, it's so unexpected. And it's pretty funny, and it's just, you know, I'm really impressed by the care and the work that they put just in the drawings and the visual aspect of the game. As for the game itself, it's mostly a puzzle game. Like, there is combat, and the combat can be pretty frustrating because it asks you to leverage all your items, and it can be a little bit complicated, but I'll come back to that later. But mostly what you're doing is, like, block puzzles. It's more on the side of, like, Adventure of Lolo block puzzles than something in Zelda, even. And you'll be asked to, you know, once you're fully equipped, you'll have an ice wand. And normally in a Zelda game, you would just be freezing enemies and then shattering them or something like that. But in this game, you're freezing enemies or you're freezing blocks so that instead of pushing them one square over, you push them all the way, make them slide to, you know, where you need them to go. There's bombs and you'll have to like light them on fire, freeze them, push them all the way across the room, and then they thaw and then they explode. And like there's a lot of you have to really mix and match your powers to get anywhere in this game. And not only like that goes for the rooms where you'll be, you know, of course, like standing on switches to open doors and stuff like that, but also against the bosses. Like the bosses, normally, you know, in a Zelda game, you would have, okay, this is the hookshot dungeon. I'm going to have to use the hookshot when the boss is opening its mouth so that I pull out the tongue or the eye or whatever, and I can smash at it with the sword. And that's basically the extent of the quote-unquote puzzle of beating that boss. But in this game, it can become like, okay, so I've got the ice wand, and if I throw it directly at the enemy, it doesn't do anything. What I have to do is shoot the ice wand at the wall, and it's going to create ice on the wall, and I have to position myself between that part of the wall and the enemy. The enemy will shoot a beam at it, and it, you know, I get out of the way, it will reflect on the ice wall and back at the enemy, you know? So, like, I'm just saying that that's just, like, one of the, you know, like, the earlier bosses. When you get to the final boss and you have to juggle between, you know, four different items, and you have to, okay, so throw ice on the wall, use the teleport beam on myself and warp myself all the way across, like, these spikes, and there's, like, five different enemies that are invincible, or nearly invincible and really hard to dispatch. And even if I were to dispatch them, like the main boss respawns them instantly. And during that time, I'm trying to be really precise and blow up these bombs under the enemy. And you have to get the timing just right. It's really, I don't know, like the game is perhaps a little bit less welcoming than it initially seems, you know?
You know, this is interesting because a lot of people voice criticism of some Zelda games that the puzzles are too straightforward, they only use one item at a time. And you're basically complaining that juggling all these different items is becoming a real chore. And
yeah.
So it makes me wonder if Nintendo kind of experimented with it and then scaled back. I mean, obviously, in something like Link Between Worlds, there's other restrictions in terms of they don't even know which items you have with you. But even other Zelda games, they always seem to pare it down. Maybe there's one or two items you got to use for a given puzzle.
Right. Well, I had the last boss was frustrating for more than just for more reason than what I just said. I'm trying not to focus too much on the negatives, but there were like several issues with the last boss. But one of the big issues also was that the game saves autosaves pretty much all the time. And so it autosaved when I entered the last boss room, and I was missing like one heart that would really have helped, because you can only have a maximum of four. And so I couldn't go back and explore more. Like, I had to fight the boss with what I had, and it seemed like it was not enough. I think that the game, that boss fight would have been less frustrating just if I had way more health. But
that sounds like a playtesting problem.
Yeah, probably. And also the game had a tendency to freeze and require a hard reset in that particular boss battle. That happened to me twice. Problem. So that's a frustration. But overall, like the game, I don't know, like really funny, really well made, and perhaps a little bit on the short side. Like, I didn't mind because I'm playing through Persona Q, and I've been playing Bayonetta 2 nonstop, and I was really glad to play a short game, but it's about like 3 hours. But then again, like the game at most is $10, so I think it was a fair price. But yeah, like I don't know, like this segment has been going all over the place. There's too much to say. But yeah, like I just, you know, check it out if you want. Like it's got.
Check it out if you want, everybody.
A strong pitch.
Oh my god.
Fuck it, I don't care. Do what you want.
Well, I'm trying to get to some other point.
I thought I was the nihilist.
Yeah. Anyway.
I don't care.
I don't know how to end a segment.
No, it's fine.
Just give it a number and call it a day.
Yeah, okay. I remember 7.5.
I remember the reception being on the lukewarm side of things, which I was like, when, you know, someone said, oh, it's like an indie Zelda. I was like, oh, cool. I want to check that out. And then, you know, when it came out on Wii U, the things I was hearing about is like, it sounds, you know, probably good, but not great. Mm-hmm. And,
That's the thing though. Like sometimes, you know, like a game gets lukewarm reviews and you think, oh, it's a lukewarm kind of game. It's not great. And it's mm-hmm. not terrible, but I think that there are really good, like really great. This game at times is great. There are some elements of it that are great. You know, I really love the mm-hmm. humor. You've got this Navi stand-in in this game. He's called Tipsy because he gives you tips. You see, but also he's got kind of a case. Yeah, he's got a case of potions, which are clearly alcohol. And so, you know, okay. Like, so this game is kind of safe for kids because it probably won't, you know, notice, but also there's some humor for older people. But so, yeah,
what,
so.
You don't want to know what Tingle has a case full of.
Oh my God, no. And the secret room in the back. But yeah, so when this game is great, like what it excels at. And then there are some problems with kind of the playability, but. I don't know if it can power through, if you don't mind a somewhat frustrating kind of battle system and really demanding puzzles. I say give it a shot.
Cool. All right. Well, I'm going to wrap up this segment with a few thoughts about the DICE Awards that happened last week. I was there. We recorded last show a day early so that I would have Thursday evening free to go to the DICE Awards here in Las Vegas. And I've never been before. You know, they've been doing it for a little – they started this a couple years before I, you know, got involved with video game media. So I've known about it for a long, long time. I've never been. And I thought, hey, now that I live here, I should try to get in. You know, maybe I can just do it after work. And so DICE is a week-long summit of mostly – it's kind of like GDC. I think it's a little more business-oriented than GDC. It's you know, a lot of executives talking about business-type stuff. But there's definitely some developer talks too, some creative stuff going on. It's a mixture of the two. There were, you know, keynotes throughout the day and meet and greet sessions. I mean, it's like, you know, most industries that people work in have these annual conferences where, you know, you spend a lot of money to go to them, but you get to meet a lot of people who work at other companies and trade ideas. And maybe, you know, you meet job contacts or you do some recruiting or you kind of try to present things about what your company is doing that sort of raise the esteem of your company in everyone else's eyes. And so, you know, it's generally not open to the public, and DICE is definitely not, and not necessarily open to the media. DICE has kind of limited media registration, and I was lucky to even get into the awards, especially kind of at the last minute. So I did not get to attend the actual conference during the day because I was at my job, my normal job. But in the evening, I went one night to go pick up my ticket for the awards ceremony. While I was there, I found out there were a couple parties going on related to DICE there at the Hard Rock Casino and Hotel. And so, I'd already driven across town to go pick that thing up. And I figured, oh, well, I should check one of these out. So I went to a party, and it was cool. I got to go around. I met the guy who runs Game Trailers, who we might try to get on the podcast here soon, with along with Dan Bloodworth, who works there with him. Dan being one of our former PGC buddies and the namer of NintendoWorldReport.com. He came up with our name back right before he left the site, I think. I ran into Perrin Kaplan, our old friend Perrin Kaplan from Nintendo of America. Longtime readers and listeners will know her name. She used to be a vice president. She left 3 or 4 years ago when Nintendo kind of downsized their Seattle or Redmond headquarters at the time and moved a lot of the PR stuff down to San Francisco and some in L.A. And they don't really do stuff up in Redmond anymore. And I think that was mostly just because the media are down there and it didn't make sense to keep flying tons of people up to Redmond all the time, which I did get to do a couple times. And it was awesome, but I'm sure it cost them a lot of money. And anyway, so I ran into Perrin and Beth Llewellyn, who used mm-hmm. to be Nintendo of America's director of PR, and they both
Jedis. I think, Jedis.
Yeah, they were the Jedis at Nintendo back in the day. Yeah, so it was cool. I ran in. There weren't a ton of people there that I knew at that party, but it was kind of fun to hang around. And I saw, you know, one or two people I recognized, but I don't really know, and I wasn't sure if I should talk to them, you know. But I had a couple of free drinks, and you know, it was very merry. It was an interesting menagerie of people, but I kind of wondered, like, man, am I going to get to the awards and not really know much of anybody? Because I didn't really know these people all that well. You know, when the person I know there is the best is Perrin Kaplan, I'm in trouble. But I got to the awards the next night, and it was a much different situation. There was kind of a pre-show cocktail hour, you know, kind of just a hanging out, meet and greet type thing. And there were a few media people there who were interviewing developers going through. I mean, I've recognized John Romero right away, and I thought, oh okay, God. That's interesting. And that ended up being actually a good kind of entry point for this event. There were a lot of very old school, you know, kind of famous legendary people at this thing. There weren't a lot. And it made me realize that, you know, when I go to E3, I've been going so many years now. I've been so many times. I feel like I know where everything is. I know who everybody is that I should talk to. I recognize just tons and tons of faces every time I go to E3. And going to the DICE Awards made me realize how many of the people at E3 that I know are just PR people, because they're the ones that I've had to interact with directly the most. You know, I know a few developers, but not that many. And at DICE, there's not that many other media people. And there are very few, if any, PR people other than the ones running the actual event. And so I'm walking around and I see John Romero and Shuya Yoshida and Mark Cerny and, you know, all these, you know, the guy who, the director of The Last of Us, who I, you know, semi-recognize, you know, like a lot of pretty well-known developers. And then Alexey Pajitnov walks around, you know, he's the guy who invented Tetris. And I would have like gone crazy and like run up and accosted him if I hadn't interviewed him a few years ago. I decided, you know, I had my one chance to be kind of a crazy person around him. I'm going to let it go this time and let somebody else do that. Cause I'm sure he gets enough attention there as it is, but, It was a cool scene. It was definitely not the usual assortment of familiar faces that I see at E3. It was a different crowd. A lot of people come to this who are kind of more or less retired, you know, from games. And it was interesting to see some of those people. A lot of them I'd never met before and didn't even try to talk to. But I did, we were waiting for the award show to start, I grabbed a little hors d'oeuvre and a drink. And just found an empty spot on this countertop just to stand there and try to drink my drink. And I was standing next to this old man. And he also appeared to be, you know, by himself, or he wasn't like with a group or anything. He was just standing there by himself eating a little meatloaf hoagie thing and drinking his wine or whatever. And so, you know, standing there kind of awkwardly for a couple minutes, just kind of munching and drinking my drink. And finally I was like, so I've never been to one of these things, you know, just kind of strike up a dry conversation out of nothing. And, so he responded and we started chatting and, I picked up very quickly that had been around in games for a long time. But I didn't recognize him. I didn't know his voice. I couldn't really see his name tag. He was wearing it, but it was like inside of his jacket, you know, and it was kind of, obscured. And we start talking about virtual reality. And, you know, I thought, oh, it'll be interesting to talk about virtual reality with someone who's, you know, much older, has probably heard about this for even longer than I have, but maybe isn't as enamored with.
I'm prepping to facepalm who
well, you know, anyway, he actually knew a fair bit about it and he was concerned about some of the neurovestibular effects and the fact that, you know, when you see these very believable things happening in your VR helmet, and yet because your inner ear isn't sensing the motion that's being portrayed on the screen, that creates mm-hmm. a cognitive disconnect and it makes people throw up. And that's not something that you can improve just with better frame rate and things like that, better resolution. And anyway, so we talked about all this stuff, and then he like casually drops into the conversation that he made Pong.
Oh my God.
I was like, oh shit. Okay. So I was talking to Al Alcorn, which is a name I'd heard before.
Wow.
And, he was actually there to receive one of the two Lifetime Achievement Awards that they presented at the awards that night. The other being Ralph Baer, the guy who literally invented Jesus. Video games and who died a few months ago, and his son accepted the award, which is, a very sweet little moment there. But yeah, Al Alcorn was the other guy. He was the third employee at Atari, and he created Pong.
And I'm going to give you a pass because I don't know that I'd recognize him now.
Yeah, I mean, how many people would just recognize him? Like,
if it was him from like the 90s, when I think was probably the last time he was really a public figure, yeah, I might have pulled it off. But I don't know how much he's aged, so.
Yeah, sure. I mean, yeah, he's probably, I'm going to say 65-ish.
He's born in the 40s.
Johnny, I'm sure he enjoyed your conversation very much because he's got a normal conversation.
Well, you know, he mentioned that he's an engineer, and I was like, oh, I'm an engineer too. Not the same kind of engineer, you know, but, you know, that became part of our conversation. And this is not related to video games really, but at one point he got into telling me about how, at the height of Atari's financial success, he owned a stake in a Learjet for fun.
Yeah.
And was one of the few Learjet owners to actually train to fly it himself. Because
accurate.
If you can, why wouldn't you? You know, like, I mean, a lot of people who own Learjets just have it as a status symbol and they don't really care about, you know, really making a practical use of it. They certainly don't care about flying it. They pay someone to do that for them. And Al Alcorn's like, no, man, I want to fly this thing. It's like the coolest plane in the world, and I own it. So he was doing simulators and, you know, getting his license for all that stuff. And he told me some funny stories about it. And all this kind of related to virtual reality, which is kind of where we started from. But it was pretty wild. It was pretty wild. And
other things. So he was on the ground floor at Apple.
Mm-hmm.
Like he Steve Wozniak level ground floor.
Yeah, yeah. He's probably got a lot of money.
And
I'm gonna say
my favorite story I've ever heard of his goes back to when he was working at Pizza Time Theater as an engineer, i.e. the forerunner of like Chuck E. Cheese.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, Pizza Time was that merged into Chuck E. Cheese. That was the Rocket Time Explosion, right?
They were, yeah.
Rock-a-fire explosion. Yes. Oh man, I wonder if he worked on that.
He must have if he was an engineer. I wish I'd known that.
I would have brought it up to him.
Oh yeah.
That's wicked. No, but you know what? Al Alcorn, I mean, he was super nice, really interesting and fun to talk to. Very, very sharp, intelligent guy and loved to talk. I kept thinking, man, I don't know if this guy's ever been on a podcast, but I would love to put him on a podcast because he got some great stories to tell and he's just very animated telling them. I think it was fun for him to be in an event like this where he could talk about some of this stuff that, you know, maybe he doesn't get a chance to talk about that stuff, you know, day to day. So, anyway, it was a wild experience and you know, I hung out with some media people. You know, I ran into Chris Kohler, our friend there. Chris was kind of, helping me get oriented a little bit at the event. And I sat with him through the award. The award show, by the way, was, I thought really nicely done. I mean, it was kind of medium glitz, you know, I mean, it wasn't the Oscars. But it was, I mean, I've been to aerospace industry conferences where they give out awards and it was way nicer than that stuff, oh, yeah. You know. So it was kind of like in the middle. They had comedian Pete Holmes hosting it and I thought he did a great job. It was very, very funny. He wasn't like insulting. I mean, he certainly expressed himself to be a big gamer, like, and was making like not making jokes about gaming being stupid or anything, but actually making jokes about specific games that I thought were actually on point and really, really sharp and really funny. And they also did some game box art photoshops that were pretty good, actually. And I actually ran into him on my way out of the after party later in the night. And he was very nice in person as well, but he also introduced me to the guy who wrote most of the material that he did. So
nice.
That was kind of a peek behind the curtain. It's like this guy, I mean, he presented it, you know, very well. And I just assumed that he wrote all of this material because he seemed to really know it and he sold it really well. But a lot of times I think when these guys are getting ready for big corporate events where they probably don't have a ton of time to get ready for it, sometimes they hire people to help them write the material. So that was kind of interesting, but I thought he did a really good job. The awards themselves, I mean, they explain some of the process that they're selected, but it's similar to the Oscars. They have a panel of experts for any given category, people who understand, you know, a lot about that particular category. So they get sound guys to select the games for best sound and they play through, you know, 30 or 40 different submissions, and then they pick five nominees, and then the nominees go out to the entire Academy, and you have to be, you know, basically a dues paying member of the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences in order to vote on these. So, you know, a lot of the acceptance speeches referred to, you know, people being so honored that their peers, like other game developers, other people in the game industry, would choose their game as the best in whatever category it was, and that is cool, but also it makes me just wonder, like, who is in this academy and what right. are they really playing? Because, you know, the people, of course, doing the final voting among the five nominees don't necessarily have played all those games. Like, that's the entire academy voting. And they haven't necessarily played all these games that are being nominated. And so you get Shadow of Mordor won like a dozen awards in almost any category you can think of, including Best Adventure Game, which it won over The Wolf Among Us. And I think Transistor, I mean, what do those games have in common, even remotely? You know, what kind of competition is this that Shadow of Mordor is up against those games? It's very strange. But Shadow of Mordor just kept winning over and over, and it got very tiresome to see the same two guys go up every time, especially when you know that like 1,000 people worked on that game and these same two guys are giving the same acceptance speech, you know, and they're running out of people to thank, and it's getting to where they're making jokes about how many times they've been up there, which is when you know it's really embarrassing. And then at the very end, the Game of the Year award went to Dragon Age Inquisition, and it was the only award they won all night, the only one, even like in the technical categories. And you can like hear the audience gasp. And the two guys from EA or BioWare who went up there to accept the Game of the Year award, like literally seemed like shocked that they won. They were like, we didn't think we were going to be getting this. So there was a little bit of drama there, and it was interesting. Nintendo won 3 awards. They won Best Handheld Game for Smash Brothers, Best Fighting Game for Smash Brothers on Wii U, and Best Racing Game for Mario Kart 8. Which, you know, I'm not going to argue with any of those. I thought they were well-deserved. There were a lot of other categories where I felt that some of the Nintendo stuff should have been nominated and wasn't. But, you know, that's my personal bias speaking, I guess. Anyway, so that's just a hint of what the experience was like. I mean, it's a very exclusive event. I really had no business being there, and I felt really kind of out of my depth and out of place a lot of the time that I was there, but I tried to make the most of it and have a really good time. And I thought I would kind of share a look into that little piece of the game industry that not very many of us get to see. So I'm very, very thankful that I got to be a part of it. And it was nice.
The whole experience you described really reminds me a lot of GDC a while back when I used to go. I think it's changed over the last few years, become a little bit more like a mini E3.
Yeah, GDC has grown a lot, and I've never been to that one either. But I know it used to be
very similar, just lots of people sharing stories and lots of parties, and you just run into random people. Like, I think I was telling you about this the other day, but I remember Chris Kohler snuck me into a Sony party. and I ran into some random Japanese dude who was by himself, who turns out had worked on Secret of Mana. I don't remember if he was a graphics artist or what. And he was trying to talk to me about God of War, the first God of War. And I'd never played the game. I didn't want to say I didn't play any Sony games because I was at a Sony party. So it was a very awkward conversation. He was trying to draw pictures of something from God of War. It was probably like the logo or one of the main things in the game plot. I just, you know, I'd had a couple of gin and tonics, so I just laughed the whole time. I was like, I don't know.
You get into these awkward, very weird, random encounters.
Yeah.
You know, when you get into those groups of people, yeah. And you just never quite know what's going to happen. I ran into Matt Casamassina at that After Awards party. I hadn't seen him in probably like 7 or 8 years. I was like, whoa, what's up? And then we were standing right next to Perrin Kaplan. I was like, oh, do you two know each other? Yeah. So that was fun. It was fun. Parts of it were a blast from the past, and parts of it were just entirely new and alien to me. But it was really fun, and I'm glad I got to be a part of it. So anyway, guys, we're going to wrap up this rather long new business and come back and do a short listener mail section. So stick around. Welcome back to the show, everybody. It is time for listener mail. And as always, the address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. TYP is going to read the first email this week.
Okay, Jason from Kentucky writes, with the upcoming release of the new 3DS and the inability for the old 3DS to play Game Boy Advance Virtual Console games or Super Nintendo Virtual Console games, do you think Nintendo will use the additional power of the new 3DS hardware to add those two systems to the 3DS Virtual Console library? For a niche market of hardcore Nintendo gamers that the new 3DS is targeted at, a feature like that would definitely be a big selling point.
Do we know that they can't, or just that they haven't?
We don't know for sure that they cannot.
I would be surprised.
We suspect that the original 3DS is not capable of doing that. And the idea is that, you know, the Ambassador GBA games. This is our best clue. They don't go to sleep when you close the lid. You can still save power by closing the lid because it does disable the speakers and the screens. It turns off the screens, mm-hmm. but it doesn't actually pause mm-hmm. the game, suspend the game in memory. And so the system is still running full blast. The processor and the RAM and everything are just like if you had it open. And we think that's because they're using the DS backwards compatibility. And of course, the DS system was backwards compatible with GBA, and we think they're using that. And of course, on the DS, it didn't support sleep mode either for GBA. And so, the reason that Nintendo never release GBA stuff on Virtual Console for 3DS is because they didn't want to do it until they could bring the compatibility up with the standard of Virtual Console, which is it at least has to function like a native game with the basic hardware features. Like if you close the system, you save battery, you know, or you can suspend and go back to the home screen, which you can't do. You remember on GBA Ambassador, once you boot that game up, when you're done, you have to power the system off. Yeah. You cannot boot back out to the home menu. You're locked into it.
It is a GBA. It is running that ARM chip or whatever as a GBA.
It's turned off parts of the system already.
It's too bad that the GBA didn't have like a an OS that with a menu, because then they could have maybe hacked an app that boots back the 3DS just like they
like
did
on
with
Wii
the,
mode.
The Wii mode, yeah, and the Wii U.
Even that is not elegant.
No.
I mean it's better than nothing, but I'm still surprised to change the subject briefly. I'm surprised on the Wii U now that you can download, they figured out a way to, you know, let you download Wii games and boot them from the Wii U home menu. Okay, then why can't it read what disc game I have for Wii when I put in the system and show that icon on the Wii U home screen and just let me boot directly into it if I want to? I can't imagine what it is about downloading the game that lets them do that, whereas if I actually have the game disc in there, it can't. And why can't it search through the SD card that I have in there that contains all my WiiWare stuff and my Virtual Console stuff from Wii? Why can't it search through there, find all those ROMs, and just list them on the Wii U home menu? It's still going to boot into Wii mode, just like it does with Punch-Out and Metroid Prime Trilogy, the stuff that you can download now. But at least they float that stuff up to the main menu so I don't have to open this whole other operating system to access it. I find that very weird, and it seems like something Nintendo should be able to continue patching until they get to the point where that backwards compatibility is a little more transparent. But maybe not. Seems like they would have done it by now if they could.
I don't really have much hope, because usually Nintendo announced these things before releasing the hardware. No, like the VC, the Virtual Console, we knew about it way before the Wii came out.
We knew the general parameters of it, but they did start to modify what it could do, what it was available for it as things went out. I'm still not convinced that these systems couldn't do it. I just don't know that it's a big priority for them. And I would point you to what the Virtual Console is getting right now on systems it does support and say it's not a big priority for them.
It's not, although it is a continuing concern. We could say that although Virtual Console has slowed down big time from what it started at, to their credit, they're still doing it. They must be making some money off of it, or they would have given up by now completely, and they haven't. They do continue to do stuff. I mean, Breath of Fire came out this week on the Wii U, which is, you know, it's a neat little game, and that's a game that probably took some doing to get on Virtual Console, because that is a game developed by Capcom and published – developed by Squaresoft, yes. Published by Capcom.
But Capcom owns all the rights to it, so.
Right. It's a Capcom published game that they own, but it was developed by Squaresoft, and it has Squaresoft logo when you boot the game up. Mm-hmm. And then Capcom used that experience to learn how to make their own RPGs, which they'd never really done before, unless you count Gargoyle's Quest, which is kind of different. And then they internally developed Breath of Fire 2, which is in a lot of ways a superior game. I know you're a big fan, James, and it seems like that may be coming.
If by a lot you mean all of them, then yes, it is a superior game.
Breath of Fire is a little clunky, but I still think it's very charming.
No, it is a very good game. Cool game. If you have not played them, you should play it. Mm-hmm. Two is better.
Two is a very impressive Super Nintendo RPG,
but,
for sure.
On the topic of GBA releases not being worth Nintendo's time to put on the
3DS. I didn't say that. I just said it's not it doesn't appear to be a big priority for
sure,
them.
Sure, but it's certainly putting GBA games on the Wii U was like, it's not a matter of priority. Otherwise, they would have put it on the 3DS,
because the Wii U didn't
right?
have any games. That was the problem. The Wii U had fucking nothing.
I guess, but you have to imagine that. I don't think that the GBA games would have pushed Wii U sales. And on the other hand, you would imagine that those games would sell way better on the 3DS.
It wasn't about how many they would sell. It was about the Wii U having things to show. Hey, the Wii U has games now.
I think it serves, you know, continuing to trickle out these GBA games or Super Nintendo games or whatever they're trickling out on Virtual Console, especially for Wii U. it does show a continued interest in releasing something on the system. These things often have a higher profile than the indie games that are coming out anyway. And so Nintendo can probably show data, I'm guessing, that correlates that when they release a popular game for Virtual Console, it gets people to go to the eShop and turn on their system and go in there, and they end up buying other things also.
I could
so
tell
maybe it's just good for business, even though they maybe don't make that much money on the Virtual Console itself. It promotes more activity on the eShop and it keeps people thinking and talking about the platform.
I can tell you definitively, like having heard what the numbers look like, the top selling Wii U eShop game in a given week sells less units than you expect.
Yeah, yeah.
Many less units than you expect.
I believe it. Yeah. I mean the install base sucks for Wii
U. I will tell
you, there aren't that many in existence.
What I really like about the GBA games on the Wii U is that they released Super Mario World for GBA on it when Super Mario World already is on the Virtual Console. So yeah. I'm really looking forward to the Breath of Fire GBA version to be on the Virtual Console soon, and maybe also Super Ghouls and Ghosts, the GBA version, and that good stuff.
I think that goes to my point, though. They're just like, we just need things on the system. And they're just like, we got this Super Mario 3 Advance. Great, put it on there.
Look at them roll out finally like Donkey Kong Country, except it's the GBA version. That's what's going to happen. I know it.
I don't think so. But I'll tell you what my theory is on why new 3DS XL is launching without any mention of an upgraded Virtual Console service for it. It's because I think the rollout of this stuff, I do think it's coming. I really do. It makes a ton of sense. It's a great revenue source. It sets apart the new 3DS even further from the previous model and encourages people to upgrade if they care about that stuff. And I think the writer of the email here is correct in that the people who are likely to buy this new system are probably the same people who are interested in Virtual Console stuff. Because it is kind of a niche product and a niche market that it's aiming for.
Yeah,
for
you
now,
say like the big selling arguments right now are the least popular Zelda 3D Zelda game and Xenoblade, you know, a very,
and
very
Monster
niche
Hunter.
Release.
Yeah. Yeah, it's all very niche stuff.
And Monster Hunter and Zelda are not exclusive to that platform.
Yeah, but right. I think the reason is that in order to do this stuff, they need two things to happen. Not just the new hardware for new 3DS, but also they have to get through this account merging stuff. Mm-hmm. Because I think what's going to happen is that these GBA and Super Nintendo games, you notice that Wii U doesn't support N64 for whatever reason, right? But all of the Virtual Console stuff that is currently on Wii U, I think can probably also run on new 3DS. And the fact that Nintendo is in the process of merging all these accounts maybe gives you a hint that they might be looking to do something a little more drastic with Virtual Console and give you access to your games on both of these systems, Wii U and new 3DS XL. Maybe you can play the same games on both.
If I could get that portable without buying those games again, that would be a huge reason to go for new 3DS.
So they're not going to let you buy these things that are currently only available on Wii U. They're not going to let you buy them on new 3DS until they have made it clear that you can either, you know, get them for free if you've already paid for them, or, you know, pay your dollar to upgrade it to a multi-platform availability, you know, whatever weird system that they end up doing for it. I suspect that it might be linked into the whole unified account thing, which they are kind of. And again, I think closing down Club Nintendo is a step in the right direction, actually, towards that unified account system.
Yeah, but if that's their plan, it's kind of a jerk move from them to let Capcom release, Final Fight, Mighty Final Fight on both Wii U and 3DS, and there are other games too. I guess they haven't told third parties.
If they have, if Capcom wants to release games on Wii U and 3DS, let's go, yes, do that.
I think it's only a jerk move if you're the kind of person who would buy it on both systems.
Who would buy Mighty Final
and
Fight on
two
systems?
And I don't think there are too many people affected by that. So
the guy who made that is probably the only person.
Because the thing is, Guillaume, that game, you know, if you bought it on 3DS, it is on your Nintendo Network account. They know that you bought it, and, sure. and you can dredge it up on another system if you make the call, right? So what that means is once they do this whole account unification thing and they enable this cross-platform virtual console business, then if you already bought it on 3DS, you should be able to then log into your Wii U and download it on there too, right?
Right.
So it's, I don't think they're really screwing out anybody here except people who bought it on both systems. And with Virtual Console, I just think that's such a small sliver of, it's such an edge case.
Yeah, but I still think they should, I don't know, try to give them something. I mean, Nintendo has
they
been
could sweeten it.
Is no, yeah, they, yeah, like
they could give them a little bit of credit for each one that they have twice.
Right, like they, I've been refunded for, because I actually bought the Wii browser back in the day, the Wii web browser, they refunded that. They gave me like 500 Wii points, and so I guess they could do that.
Yeah, they could. So,
or they could say, you fucking bought Mighty Final Fight twice? What the hell's wrong with you?
Yeah, I think it sucks more for something, and there's very few cases of this, but something like Shovel Knight, which is out on both platforms, sold separately at, you know,
full price.
Yeah,
but that's also not their call on that game.
Right. That's not Nintendo's problem, really, because they didn't make that game. So that wasn't their choice. And I do think, you know, once all this stuff happens, then maybe going forward, indie developers will have the option to do a cross-buy if they want to. You know, Nintendo's already testing the waters with Mario versus DK in about a month, or no, end of February.
Well, indie developers could have done that already. They could have gotten codes and given them to you. If they,
maybe that's a very inelegant system. I think
it is.
I think, you know, they might be moving towards a better way of doing it.
So the only thing I can think of that might mess up plans for Super Nintendo on new 3DS is I'm a little worried about the resolution of the screens. And I'm not an expert on this, so I apologize if I'm misstating here, but I think that at least some Super Nintendo games have a resolution that's higher than what 3DS displays.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking at the specs here, and
like 480.
The top screen for the 3DS is only 240 vertical pixels.
It's 256 for Super Nintendo, I think.
Yeah, there are at least some games that do that. So,
they would look like butt.
Yeah, that may be a reason why they're not doing it.
Or maybe those games won't be compatible. You know, maybe they exempt certain ones because of technical reasons.
They've done that GBA kind of thing games before. For sure would work.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, the 256 is for the horizontal for Super Nintendo. It's according to Wikipedia, it can do a vertical resolution of 224, 239, 448, or 478 pixels vertically. So,
yeah,
some games, I don't know how many, but some games, it may not be able to display too well.
Yeah, I don't think very many games ran in those high resolution.
It's weird because of how it does layers and stuff. Different layers were able to use different resolutions, and with the net effect ends up boiling down to one of those kind of combo numbers. It's a funky technical thing they're doing, and I can't claim to be an expert on it. But yeah, you could definitely there are definitely Super Nintendo games whose resolution, at least on on regular standard TVs as defined by the as we would discuss on North American television, could in theory be a higher resolution than they were on a 3DS, or they would be on a 3DS.
Right, and although the shape of the pixels are different on an LCD screen, that's probably more of an issue for the horizontal aspect, and I don't think there's an issue there, because without 3D turned on, you have 800 pixels horizontally, so that shouldn't be an issue.
Well, you do have 800 pixels horizontally, but remember, it's also stretched. It's a 16:9 format versus a 4:3.
Right.
So there's some, you could solve this problem, but this goes back to
it's going to be emulated, you know.
Yeah,
so
right. This goes back to when you look, but they are super, super particular about how they want their stuff emulated. It goes back towards, when we'd see GBA ports of Super Nintendo games, you're like, this looks really weird. And part of that was the resolution issue. And they had to conquer it by hand for each of those games. And maybe it's just not worth the blood, sweat, and tears to figure out how to make the emulator and make those games look good.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see. It'll be interesting. I hope my theory is right, but it could very well be wrong.
Well, there's no reason why they can't for GBA.
No, there's not.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll see. All right, so let's move on and have Guillaume read the next email.
Tripon writes, recently, Apex was held, the biggest Smash competitive tournament of the year, with Nintendo sponsorship. With competitive games like Splatoon and Pokken coming out, do you see Nintendo participating in this community like Valve and Riot Games do with Dota and League of Legends?
Dota, yeah.
I'm going to use this.
It says dots, but it's a typo.
I'm going to use this opportunity to plug
a... Dots and lol.
Oh, I'm going to use this opportunity to plug a podcast that I appeared on, headed by NWR Fighting Fanatic Ty Shugart, that may or may not come out. That's 3 hours long and is a real mind trip. But if that game, if that podcast ever comes out, we actually discuss this. So I'll just give my real abridged answer, was they'll be involved as long as they have a game to sell that they think will appeal to that audience coming out.
Yeah.
Or recently released. If they don't, they ain't going to be there.
Yeah. No, I completely agree. I don't think Nintendo has any existential interest in this stuff. I think they care about it insofar as it gets a certain audience to be interested in Nintendo games who otherwise would not be. And they're smart for getting involved with it. And it's pretty low-level involvement. I mean, I don't think this is like super big dollars. I don't think it involves half the company or, you know, anything like that. I think it's sending out one or two reps to set up a couple of demo kiosks and be around to, you know, run security and talk to people.
For Splatoon, yes, but they were heavily invested in the Smash tournaments at Apex.
In what way?
They provided hundreds of GameCube adapters for the controllers.
Okay. Copies. That's cool.
They provided copies of the games. They may have provided the hardware to play the games on. So they were financial. They were a financial sponsor of the, they may have been the lead financial sponsor for that particular Apex.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, they were heavily invested, but they were heavily invested to promote Smash Brothers and to promote Splatoon.
Yeah. Yeah, and I wonder if Splatoon will really be one of those games that you can play all that competitively. You know, because if the online ends up being kind of borked because of the lack of features, or, you know, if the net code isn't all that great, or if people just don't think there's that much depth. I mean, Smash Brothers is popular at these tournaments because it has an incredible amount of depth. People come up with new techniques in Melee even now, and that game is pretty old, 14 years old now. So, I think it's interesting to see Nintendo involved here, because it maybe teaches them something about why people like their games and what people find interesting about them. And I wonder if it maybe, probably not, but I wonder if it could influence Nintendo just a little bit to add additional layers of depth to these games. I mean, I feel like with Sakurai, he's going to do that anyway. That's just how he rolls. That's the kind of games he makes. And with Pokken Fighters, you know, that's made by Bandai Namco. Yeah. And they're going to do that anyway because, I mean, it's made by, you know, the Tekken people. And so that's just the kind of game that they're used to making. So it's going to meet that certain standard. Splatoon is a whole different animal. And that's why I think Splatoon is the most interesting test case here, because it's a game made by people who don't necessarily have any experience making a game for a competitive audience like that, who are really going to drill down and find out, like, what is the best strategy? What are the exploits? You know, what are the things I can do that the developers maybe didn't even anticipate? And then will the developers react by patching things out, or will they, you know, add features that make it easier for people to play it in this particular way that they're going to end up finding? It'll be really interesting to see how Nintendo responds to the response to that game.
And the other thing is that game has not been publicly playable, I want to say, since E3.
No, it hasn't. And at Apex, they brought the E3 demo. So it was not anything new there. That's why there was not really any news about Splatoon from Apex, because it was the same old demo. It was nothing new to it.
But this game also served a timeline point of Nintendo going, hey, remember, this game still exists.
Oh, yeah.
Totally. I'm a little surprised they didn't bring it to PAX South, but I think PAX South was kind of like when we had the first PAX East and we're like, I don't know what we're getting into here.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like the feedback, A, there wasn't a lot of buzz that came out of that one, like, it just kind of happened, and B, it did feel, you know, the buzz that came out felt a lot like it was just kind of a thing that happened, and this was gonna take a couple years to get rolling. I expect it'll be in Boston.
The thing with PAX, yeah, Splatoon probably will be in Boston, but I think it'll be that E3 demo again.
Oh yeah, it'll be that, but it'll be the first, you know, major public event that it'll been playable at.
That's fair. Yeah, fair enough. And it is a big demo. Like, it, you need a lot of floor space to set up 8 Wii U's and 8 TVs and 8 copies of that game.
I mean, it was 16. Well, no, because it was two sets of eight. Two sets of eight and a set of eight behind that set of eight for the press.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was a freaking, it was huge.
Humongous, yeah. Took up a huge corner of the booth. But, yeah, I think with PAX, we really shouldn't be setting these high expectations for, like, is this PAX going to be a lot different from the other ones, or are there going to be all these exclusive announcements or game impressions coming out of it? The point of PAX South is to let people who live far away from Boston and Seattle go to a PAX.
Sure.
That's exactly why. And it's great that they did that. And that's the only reason that they need to do a PAX South.
No, I get that. My point was I'm not surprised they didn't bring it there, because I think there was a lot of wait and see on that one just by everybody.
It was also really close to Apex, so maybe they just didn't have the people and the copies of the demo to do both.
Yeah, but I would be shocked if it's not playable in some form in Boston.
Yeah.
Unless they're just not going, which they've done before. They've just straight up said we're not going to be there.
They could skip it.
The first 2 years they just sent PR. They sent PR contractors and just said, yeah, just demo some 3DS games, whatever.
Mm-hmm. I remember. All right. Well, I guess we covered it.
Yeah.
Covered that email pretty well. Let's do one more. I think this one will go pretty fast. The next email from Darth Cadus, and he writes. First off, disclaimer, Smash Wii U is the first Smash Brothers game I've ever played. For my money, literally, the whole point of Amiibo is to collect the favorite characters, right? Collect your favorite characters.
It just happens to be his favorite characters are all of them.
So in Smash U, I've been playing almost exclusively in 8-player mode using my 6 Amiibo, Link, Toon Link, Zelda, Sheik, Yoshi, and Luigi, with myself as the 7th player and no CPU. Or all of those Amiibos are CPUs, I hope you realize. My question is, if all my favorite characters are already taken in Amiibo slots, who should I choose? I guess who should choose to play as himself? The strongest, the quickest, the most resilient, or just a Sonic? As a 33-year-old...
Get out of this email right now! Get out!
Dude, it was a pretty good diss, actually.
Yeah. All right. As a 33-year-old Smash Brothers newcomer, I welcome any character advice you can give.
Oh my god! Oh boy. Well, first off, you can play as the same character as an Amiibo, so if there's anyone you like playing as, you can do that.
Although, as a newcomer, that might be a little bit confusing. Like, if you're not used to Smash Brothers, that might make it harder to understand.
I mean,
make sure you select your name and then your name.
Yeah, and pick an alternate color pattern. And the alternate color patterns are pretty good.
Yeah.
Wireframe hooded Little Mac is a personal favorite of mine, just for the sheer novelty of it being wireframe hooded Little Mac.
Yeah. It's very silly and awesome that they let you play as that.
I'll say you play Smash Brothers very differently from me. I have no interest in Amiibos. Very little interest in playing against computer players other than maybe one or two just to sharpen my skills or whatever. Mm-hmm. I'm probably going to steal Johnny's answer here, but play as random. You'll have more fun learning the different characters and seeing different things that can happen.
Yeah, random is a good way just to, because there's so many. You know, there's like 50 characters in this game, and even with the 6 of your favorites taken up by the Amiibos, there's still a whole bunch for you to mess around with, and it could take you a long time to really go through them and spend time with them. The nice thing about random is you save time on picking, because you don't have to pick, it picks for you, and you're probably going to get something different than any of those Amiibos. And it lets you sample characters that you might not otherwise be drawn to, you know, just because you're not familiar with that series. Maybe you don't play Fire Emblem and you don't really know who Marth is. And you can't be blamed for that. He's a pretty obscure character. So, you know, random lets you try these characters and maybe something about them just feels good. And then maybe you stick with them for a few more rounds and try to, you know, test out all the moves and get a few things down and try them in different situations. And then maybe that can become one of your new favorites. The other thing it's hard to just recommend a character to you without knowing how you play the game. Like, what part of the game is it that you do you like the item usage? Do you like to reflect things a lot? Do you like heavier characters who charge up big attacks, or do you like projectile type characters? Do you like really fast characters who dart all over the place and are really hard to defend against because they're so fast? And a lot of characters are combinations of these, you know, and so, and some of them are just almost unclassifiable, like Duck Hunt, you know, is just completely bizarre and worth trying. Even if you've never touched Duck Hunt, the game, in your life, you should try Duck Hunt once you unlock it, because that character is just sort of doesn't incomparable to all the other characters. It just doesn't play anything like any of the other ones. And, you may hate it, you may love it, but you won't know until you spend some time with it and try it out and, you know, try to get a feel for it. So that's what I would say. I would treat it as a buffet and just try as many as you can. And if you just can't even decide where to start, random is a great way to just, you know, speed up the process and not worry about it too much, and just try whatever they throw at you and see if you like it or if you don't.
So if you guys are done,
yeah,
I'm going to go ahead and drop reality. And the reality is, if you're not playing as Jigglypuff, you're failing. Because
Johnny's pretty good at Jigglypuff.
There's a couple things. One, it's actually kind of an effective character.
Mm-hmm. He is.
But two, the trolling potential is unparalleled. I mean, well, really,
if you're playing
really
against
next
Amiibo,
year.
Do you
yeah,
really
I don't
care
think
about
Amiibo
trolling?
Care.
Well, you do, because you need to learn, because you need to get online and just yeah. grief the shit out of people with Jigglypuff to the point where people just don't want to play with you anymore, because that's the goal. Then you go back to your Amiibo because no one will play with you anymore.
The tricky thing about trolling people online with Jigglypuff, James, is that the move that really, really wrecks people is rest. And Jigglypuff's rest move can be difficult to use effectively if you have any lag.
It can be difficult to use effectively, period. But
well, yeah. But it's much harder to use if you have any lag.
So Jigglypuff's
the timing is just very narrow.
There's two troll moves now with Jigglypuff. There's that, and then there's also its final smash, which is
just
stupidity in just video game form.
It's beautiful. Yeah.
And on the right stage, it's devastating because there's nowhere to go.
Mm-hmm. Fun times. Yeah, I love Jigglypuff, but he's a little technical. Not the easiest for a newcomer to get good with Jigglypuff.
But you do have you do have really good recovery, which is
true.
And there is a tactic of in a stock match, which is part of the reason I don't like stock that much, of just jumping in the air and floating around, letting people beat the shit out of each other, and just staying away.
I just think, you know, like Tripon is starting out, like never has really played the game before. I'm not sure if giving him one character to start with is really that helpful. And I was kind of wondering, surely this exists on the internet, but maybe Nintendo World Report missed an opportunity here to make a video about, you know, basically a tutorial how to play the game. And I know like it sounds silly because Smash Brothers, it's supposed to be easy to get into and everything like that. But then, you know, sometimes I read on message boards and people talk about their edge game. And I'm like, what language are you speaking here? Exactly. Like, I'm not familiar with this. And, you know, it just feels when you're starting out and, you know, in a long running series like this, that everyone else knows exactly what they're doing, and you're kind of left like you don't understand what they're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. Like, is there such a resource? Maybe check on YouTube. Like, there are tutorials and
watch the demo reel. All Smash Brothers games.
But it doesn't really go far enough. Like, the demo reel will show you, okay, just like smash the stick to the side, and you know, do an attack and.
Mm.
I don't know.
There are video tutorials out there for Smash Brothers. There are video tutorials out there for every game. I'm sure Smash Brothers already has 1,000.
Yeah, but they may be too in the weeds or technical. You know, I don't really understand edge guarding all that well. I've never cared to invest my time in learning things like which attacks counter which other attacks or overpower.
Yeah, that's my concern.
I just like having fun with the game.
Right. If you go just searching YouTube for Smash Brothers tutorials, you're going to go down a deep, dark hole of wave dashing and stuff like that. Not that that stuff isn't worth learning at some level for certain people, but for Tripon, who's just trying to have fun with the game for the first time ever, you just need to get into this super technical stuff.
You just need to use better Google skills then. You could say like basic Smash Brothers tutorial or introduction to Smash Brothers play or something along those lines.
Right. Yeah, maybe so. Anyway. But even then, I wonder if, you know, maybe it's the basic tournament play, you know, like the
there's enough people out there just trying to get their YouTube bucks. Somebody's made these videos.
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah, because that would probably be useful. And I do like, you know, the situation you described, TYP, about about these long running series and finding it a little bit daunting to jump into. I feel that way all the time about lots of series.
Yeah, I mentioned that, but Tripon,
by the way.
And yeah, like I feel that way about Bayonetta. You know, like I've been playing a lot. I've been finishing the game on hard, but I still don't know. Like people talk about dodge offset, and I'm like, is this something that I'm supposed to have learned from this game?
That's going to back towards character action game terminology. This game has a move or has moves that are named certain things that are dodge offsets, but dodge offset is a categorization of move type that shows up in that community.
I see. So
don't worry too much about that specific name. There are moves that do what it says, or there are skills that are effectively dodge offsets.
Anyway, I guess then my advice would be try stuff for yourself for a while up to a point, and then maybe check out those videos to get a better feel for what they're talking about, and then go back and try to apply what you've learned.
That's good advice, TYP.
Thanks, John.
Sorry about that, man. Oh boy. Yeah, I don't know about you guys. I'm tired. I'm getting over a cold, and I'm starting to feel it after a couple hours here on the podcast. So we better wrap it up. Thank you everyone for writing in. I do want to note we got a couple emails about the 100% scanning topic in Metroid Prime and exploding that out to a larger discussion about
we're saving that for John, really.
Yes. I think that is a really interesting discussion for us to expand upon and get into different aspects of it, and I'm excited to do that, but I didn't want to do it without John here because he brought it up originally, and I know he has a lot to say on it. So we'll try to do that maybe next week when John's back. Thank you everyone for writing in. Please send in your own email about any topic in video games. We'd love to hear from you. I saw someone in GAF this week said, I really wish they would do a listener mail topic about such and such, and I'm like, then why don't you write an email about it? Because we don't make these things up. You know, we talk about the things that people write about. So, if you've never done it before, please don't be shy. We'd love to hear from you. The address again is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. TYP, yes. Why don't you plug your podcast?
Well, I am the host of Radio Trivia Podcast Edition, which comes out once every other fortnight or so, and it's a fun show. We play video game music, and it's your job to figure out what game it is, and even if you don't figure it out, it's a lot of fun because you hear new music and we talk about the game. So the most recent episode was with none other than Greg Leahy, which came out a few weeks ago, and that was a long episode. It's a lot of fun. It's a really good episode. So if you're an RFN fan and you don't listen to Radio Trivia, check out at least that episode, because I think if you miss Greg, you'll get a big helping of him.
If you've never listened to it before, Greg's been on a bunch of times. So
that's true.
And these episodes don't really go bad. You know, they're archival quality because they're not about current events or anything like that. So dig through the old ones. There's more than 100. And there's just so much good stuff. I think you should listen to all of them. And I'll be on it soon, I hope.
Yes. And, well, we've been planning something. Johnny and I got to actually execute.
Yeah, I want to do one of those where I pick the games and you don't know what they are, and I make you play. It's been years since we did that. It's a little extra work for me, it's fun to do, and I think it should be fun for you too. So maybe we'll do that. But anyway, you can find Radio Trivia on iTunes or, of course, at our website, NintendoWorldReport.com. Click on the podcast link, and you'll see it in the listing of all the other podcasts that we have going on. So thank you very much, TYP, for being on the show. Also, I want to remind everybody to start, if you have not already, start playing Pokemon the Trading Card Game for the next retroactive. I downloaded it. Guys. I'm going to start it this weekend. Let me play it on my new 3DS XL, playing Pokemon the Trading Card Game.
Good use of that new technology there, Johnny.
That's right. Speaking of virtual console. All right. Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll be back next week.
Bye.
Bye.
Dodge offsets are techniques to continue your combos outside of a dodge. But I screwed up. Sorry. Also, bye.